From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, thank you for coming in, even though you're on staycation.
You know, this is the final hours of my week staycation. I had a great time.
Well, you're working during the course of the next hour. At least I hope you perceive
it. If the show drags, I can start talking about tarantulas that I saw at the Museum of Natural History.
Well, we don't want to talk about tarantulas. Well, maybe we do, but in another form. We're talking about the State of the Union address and the fact that the president delivered it before some people who might be considered tarantulas and some who may consider him a tarantula. But the fact of the matter is that he delivered it to the Congress of the United States, and he did not mention the lack of voting rights or the lack of statehood for the District of Columbia. When he is in the Congress of the United States, is he technically even in the District of Columbia at all?
He's owed for, what, five or six? How many State of Unions? I mean, I offered to take some people to dinner if the president dare would mention voting rights or statehood for the District of Columbia. And he didn't do it. Not a peep from the mayor, not a peep from the council members, elected officials.
The mayor was there as a guest of Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton.
All right, she was not a guest of the president. I just, you know, as I've written and said any number of times, the people who want voting rights and statehood can't be so passive. If they're going to be so passive about these things, then they're just not going to ever get it. They have to raise it to a level of consciousness that for other people. And the president has under no compulsion to the more than just passing, saying, oh, yeah, we should have voting rights, as if we should have a new car or something.
My prediction is that he will say that in his final State of the Union address.
It's the least powerful one of all.
Correct. Joining us in studio is Kaya Henderson. She is the chancellor for the District of Columbia Public Schools. Kaya Henderson, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Sherwood and I usually participate in discussion of a few other topics before we get to the specific topics for which you are here. So please feel free to join in, because the next topic affects everyone who rides Metro in this town. Tom Sherwood, the reports that we're getting now, and according to your column in the current newspaper, seem to indicate that the problem that Metro had last week was not a problem of insufficient funding for infrastructure, but was a much simpler problem of lack of appropriate communication. You quoted your favorite movie in which Cool Hand Luke, in which it said, what we've got here is a failure to communicate.
Yes, that's exactly what the problem is. It's and I just find it astonishing. 47 years into us having a metro system, there's still continuing confusion about what do first responders do when there's an incident inside our metro system. What are there, 91 stations now? How many stations there are? What do they do? What's the protocol? I hate the word protocol, interoperability, all those bureaucratic words that I choke on. What I want to know is, why can't we have a system where if there's smoke in the tunnel, there's certain things work. The exhaust fans work. The third rail is cut off. Firefighters know that they can go in safely to a tunnel. Passengers know that they can be let out of a tunnel. It is almost just the ABCs of what you do in an emergency. I just dread the day if we should have some system-wide event that we just—it's just terrible.
Metro is in search of a new general manager. We don't know how long Kaya Henderson is going to be the school's chancellor.
I do 2017.
2017.
Yeah. She's, so yeah. You should watch Channel
I think I announced that for the first time here,
she
right?
She certainly did. She certainly did.
But so, I'm sorry, I interrupted your deep thought.
I was wondering if she was contemplating what it would be like to be the head of Metro in Washington.
I have not contemplated that at all. education, not
our students getting, you know, and Muriel Bowser, current mayor, you know, got legislation passed to allow Metro free rides for students. Is that working out as far as you can tell?
It's a huge, huge boost for us. When we were looking into truancy issues, I sat down with a number of young people at Ballou and at Anacostia, and one of the things that kept rising to the top was the cost of transportation was actually making a lot of young people truant. I taught in New York City, where kids virtually get to ride the subway and bus system for free to go to and from school. And so I'm thankful to then council member and now Mayor Bowser for introducing that legislation, but we still have a way to go. Because only the buses are free. We need Metro to be free for our students.
Oh, when you look at the fact, you told me something new. I thought it included the rail lines.
Not the rail lines. And so many of our young people cross the city to go to different schools. We have a system of choice. Our young people need to have free transportation in order to go to and from school.
Oh, well, I've learned something.
Our guest is Kaya Henderson, Chancellor, Schools Chancellor for the District of Columbia Public Schools. You can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show if you have questions or comments for her. This week, you announced the $20 million Empowering Males of Color Initiative, a plan that will include mentoring, grants, and opening an all-boys prep school. Tell us more about this, what this plan entails, and what results you hope to see from it.
Sure. I mean, we know by looking at a number of different data points that are that while DCPS has experienced a lot of progress, not all of our students are experiencing the same level of that progress. And our African-American and Latino boys are not growing and rising as fast as we need them to. And if we're going to be the best urban school district in the country, then we've got to make sure that we're taking care of that population of students. And so we are doing a couple of different things over the next 3 years. First, we're going to engage the community because we actually believe the community has a lot of the answers around how we should better support our young people. We are in the midst of a campaign to recruit 500 literacy tutors for our struggling boys of color in the early grades. And we're partnering with great organizations like a Literacy Lab and Reading Partners and Reach Incorporated to train the volunteers so that those struggling readers can get the one-on-one help they need. We have a student task force of boys of color who can inform our thinking on this work. We're actually going to celebrate our young people of color with the community through a bunch of recognition ceremonies and new opportunities, because we only want to talk about the negative around our young men. And our young men are brilliant and wonderful, and we need to begin to celebrate them.
Why the all-male prep school?
Well, one of the things that we have seen work is in Chicago, there are three charter schools called Urban Prep Academies. They are 100% African-American boys, and every kid that they graduate goes on to college, and they make sure that those young men go not just to college but through college. And
when I went to an all-male high school, is the purpose of this to avoid, well, the distractions that come from having co-ed schools?
I don't even know if it's about, at this point, the distractions, right? I think initially in the single-gender education movement, there was some of that. I think there's a recognition that boys and girls learn differently. But what I saw in Chicago at Urban Prep was not just about academic preparation. It was about manhood development. It was about confidence building. It was about building relationships between and among men that I think would prepare our young people not just for academic success, but for success
it's
in
like,
life.
It's like a club and our team spirit. We are not just everybody. We are somebody special. We're going to a special school. This school wants to talk to me. This school wants to identify me.
That's right. There are role models. I mean, many of the teachers at Urban Prep are African-American males. And, you know, the results that they're producing with some of the most challenging young people in Chicago are astounding.
And although young men are the key issue here, I mean, some people say there are arguments for a female school of a similar nature. I mean, you could really have that.
Here's the thing. I think if people haven't figured it out yet, At DCPS, we're willing to be innovative around whatever best practices there are to get.
But the fact is that girls do seem to be doing better than boys at a certain
age. In DCPS right now, girls are doing better. I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, all of our kids need to do better, and that's what DCPS has been working on. But we recognize that if we don't, I mean, I think Ferguson and Staten Island and Chicago have taught us that our young men are living a different life than many of the rest of us.
Do you have to miss, if I'm a young man in school, a young African-American man in school, do I have to misbehave in order to get to the school, or is this going to...
Not at all, no.
Does it depend on your grades at all?
No, in fact, it will be a lottery system. You'll apply just based on your interest in the school, and we'll randomly select the young people who want to go.
Is the $20 million that you and the mayor have announced, is that new money? Is that... I know that David Catania, late of the mayor campaign and education chairman for the council...
He's not late.
Late of the
formerly...
Late of the campaign. That's proper
You're
English.
Killing the man off.
No, late of the mayor's campaign.
Okay, anyway. Fine.
Anyway, yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chancellor of the school system. Highly educated, I might add. Now I forgot. No, he put in $80 million, a special. He got the council to add an additional $80 million.
No, that's actually
different
not
money.
Right. No,
it's not right.
No, he proposed an $80 million promise fund around college scholarships, but that was not passed.
Right.
So this is new money that we will be raising from philanthropic givers, from foundations, from corporations.
Similar to the ones who gave money for the teacher and
absolutely.
And
okay, yes.
Good. All right. Now, is the current council chairman for education, David Grosso, on board with this?
Absolutely.
Are you having a good time with him?
I am having a good time with him. We're having a great time. We have met a number of times to figure out what our shared agendas are and our opportunities for partnership. Councilmember Grosso was with us at the announcement on Wednesday, and you know, he's very excited about this work, and he said publicly at the announcement that the council, he thought there were a number of ways that the council could be supportive of this, and so I'm excited.
He's going to be aggressive, but he's not maybe like you and Michelle Rhee, you are seen as a more friendly person than Michelle Rhee was. Maybe David Grosso is still going to be aggressive, but a little bit more friendly than David Catania's reputation?
Here's the thing. I think that at the end of the day, all of us are urgent and pressed about doing what's right for kids as quickly as possible. But I think this work is complex. I think that this work, I think there's a lot to do around relationship building if we're going to have long-term success. And I think, you know, Grosso just has a very different style than Mr. Catania did.
Speaking of relationships, you're now working for a new mayor. What is front and center on your agenda this year as you begin working with Muriel Bowser?
Well, I mean, Mayor Bowser has been great in recognizing that we've made a lot of progress, and she said, I want that progress to continue. That's why I'm keeping you. And so I think we're continuing an agenda of deep investment in rebuilding D.C. public schools. We reinvested some years ago in early childhood education and then in elementary education. Last year, $17 million towards completely rethinking middle grades education. And so front and center for me are now rethinking high schools, figuring out how we do high schools in a completely different way, one that engages kids and makes it relevant and real for their lives afterwards. I'm also, of course, committed to ensuring that our young men of color have what they need. And then really, I'm mostly focused on equity. I think we can no longer be a city where there are pockets of excellence here and there, and we push just for more pockets of excellence. We have to ensure that every single school across the city is providing the level of academic rigor, the level of social and emotional supports, the kinds of extracurricular activities that we want for every one of our kids.
The CFO this week, the chief financial officer of the city, released a report saying that, and some disturbing to many, that young parents who have their first child are as likely to leave the city by the time that child is four as they were in 2000. Now, the enrollment has significantly changed for the better, but Did that discourage you, worry you? What are your thoughts about that report? It's a fairly detailed report.
It didn't discourage me or worry me at all, right? It just puts the problem up front, and that is, you know, for 40 years, DCPS has lost its credibility with the citizens of the district because we haven't been able to deliver the kind of quality that they deserve. And every day, we're working to restore people's confidence in our system. And I think the simple fact that for the last 3 years, we've seen enrollment increases, when for 40 years we had only seen enrollment declines, means that some people are seeing something different. We had 1,250 new students to DCPS this year over the number that we had last year, and I think that means that parents are voting with their feet, and we expect more of that.
Our guest is Kaya Henderson. She is the Chancellor of the District of Columbia Public Schools. You can follow our live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there, or you can just call 800-433-8850, as has Melvin in Washington, D.C. So please don your headphones so you can hear what Melvin has to say. Melvin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so kindly. I had a question, and I thank you so much. You have answered one of mine. Since your initiative is to really address the deficits that kids of color, my question is about the new middle school at Brooklyn. I hope that you will think in terms of, as the principal, a person of color, because that would go a great way in meeting some of the needs of those kids who come in to that brand new middle school. But here's my question. I went to the community meeting that you had to select the principal for the new middle school, and I was disappointed because I just thought it was a lack of transparency. Was it your idea to bring candidates to this meeting, and we did not know who they were? The resumes had been somewhat redacted to not include the names, so we didn't really have good information to go on as a community. To make
your concern, Melvin, you called on
a show
before, is about the principal selection process.
Yeah, yes. So we are in a pretty unique situation with the opening of the new Brookland Middle School for the Arts and World Languages, which is an amazing new location that we're opening in August. And we are in the midst of the principal selection process. And unlike other community panels where we're able to put the principal candidates in front of folks, there are a number of sitting DCPS principals who are interested in the role, but who, if they don't get the role, they don't want their existing school communities to be frantic about the fact that they are interviewing for this. And so this is kind of a situation that we haven't had before. And so not knowing what the right answer was, I personally called the Ward 5 Education Council and said, how should we handle this situation? And they made some suggestions around having a process where we put the information in front of people, but we redact the identifying factors. And so we had the meeting, and I think by all accounts it was less than successful because people weren't able to get all of their questions answered. And so my team is going back with the Ward 5 Education Council to figure out what we can do to give people
more information. That's a really intriguing problem.
Well, yeah, but at some point, you're the chancellor of the school.
Mm-hmm.
You're the manager of the school. You're the person who makes the executive decision on
yes.
which the school rises or falls. If you democratize everything, where who gets appointed to this, or you do the same thing for coaches, I mean, can't you – obviously, you can invite public to be involved, but at some point – people have to make executive decisions, and then you can be held accountable if the principals are any good, whether it's Wilson or any school.
Let me tell you who's not afraid of making executive decisions. But I actually fundamentally believe that you get to better answers when you work and engage the community. And so we have a process where the community looks at candidates, they make recommendations to me, and then I make the final decision, right? And I think that's the best of both worlds.
It's not paralysis by analysis where months go by when you could actually make these decisions in a matter of weeks.
No, not at all. I mean, it happens really quickly.
There's some controversy, not over that, but over principal termination. In December, it was announced that Principal Peter Cahill of Wilson High School's contract was not renewed. That decision sparked anger from parents and teachers who feel that Cahill had made improvements during his time as principal. You said you wish you could discuss this openly.
I mean,
why can't you?
Because there are personnel rules that we are bound by, right? that, I mean, it's not just the K-Hall case, right? In any time we terminate somebody or not renew their contract or whatever, there are always, you know, there's always more to the story than we can actually say publicly. And, you know, what I hope, I think, you know, people are accustomed to a DCPS that was random and willy-nilly in terms of terminations and that kind of thing. And I think we've gotten really, much better, even when we can't explain. I think we've gotten better at ensuring that the replacement principal is better than the principal who left. And, you know, I hope that at some point soon, people begin to trust our decision making.
Also been talk about principals' one-year contracts generating a lack of trust and a high turnover rate. Can all schools and principals be measured by the same yardstick every year, regardless of previous circumstances?
Nope. That's why we set different goals with different principals, depending on their unique circumstances. I'm totally supportive of a three-year contract for principals. In fact, my human capital team put that on the table during negotiations, and so we're working with the CSO to figure out
CSO.
How we, the Council for School Officers.
That's
which
the
is
union the for
union,
the principals.
Yeah, thank to you. Figure out how to make that happen. Let me just say one thing, though, because I got a nasty tweet saying, well, if, you know, K-Hall's on a one-year contract, maybe Kaya Henderson should be on a one-year contract. Little do people know I've been on a one-year contract since I started on November 1st, 2010.
Welcome to Tom and my world.
Well, you know, contracts are kind of, I mean, but I do think the principals, if you're going to have a principal come into a school, and it's the Council of School, what's it?
Officers.
They ought to change their name to Principals Union.
So well, you can remember. It's not just
you know,
principals.
I am really for clarity. I don't like the
too.
Word interoperability words for Metro. I want to call it communication.
Okay.
But you know, it seems to me that a principal would want a 2 or 3 year contract, which obviously could be disrupted if they failed for a variety of reasons. But it just seems to me that the bureaucracy strangles. I mean, why don't we
Here's the thing. We generally, when we hire new principals, our expectation is that they'll be there for 3 years, barring something big or crazy happening.
This is a negotiated thing with the principals union, the one-year contracts.
It's in the DCMR, actually.
What is that?
Municipal regulations.
You know, I don't allow any.
So we can work with the education committee to change the DCMR to allow us to extend longer contracts to principals.
Have time for one more call because our school's chancellor has to leave.
We haven't talked about boundaries.
Okay, go ahead.
Boundaries. It was a big deal in the mayoral campaign. What's happening with parents who are wondering where their kids are going to school? The boundaries changing for the first time in 60 years? I mean, since the 1960s. Is it going to go into effect this fall?
Yeah, we're in the midst of the lottery, and so parents have the information that they need. The mayor, you know, had some concerns about some of the ultimate recommendations.
It's her word for kids not going to Wilson being one of them, but go ahead.
So the deputy mayor and I are working on some, you know, small adjustments that we think we could make that would support the mayor's position, but also, you know, really continue to preserve the community engagement process. The community spoke in a way that...
Community engagement process.
Well,
you know,
this
kids going to be still able to go to Wilson. Wilson's oversubscribed. It's like 300 students are in... Where are you going to put them?
Not everybody who was able to go to Wilson is going to
I'm
be able to go to Wilson.
I'm looking for FEMA
anyway.
Trailers
Chancellor
there.
Henderson, we know you have to go, but while we were talking to you, Rashawn Baker snuck in the studio. He's the executive of Prince George's County, Maryland. He's a Democrat. Rashawn Baker, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm a big Kaya Henderson fan.
Oh, thank you. I'm a big Rashawn Baker fan.
we
need to get rid of both of
them. You got to watch, you know, Prince George's
then
County
just
steals.
Take over the show, Rashawn. It's all right.
How does the work that she is doing with young black men relate to what you've been doing in Prince George's County? Where are the similarities there?
You've done a great job in the District of Columbia, and we actually watch what you've done in the District of Columbia, especially with our younger black males. With the Promise Keepers that's coming up, we've looked at how much you've worked in the school system, how opportunities and mentoring. And so we're doing the same thing in Prince George's County. And it's interesting because, you know, our kids go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So they will spend some time in the District of Columbia, and then they'll come back to Prince George's County. And so, as much as we can coordinate our efforts to enrich these lives. It'll help us both.
Yeah, and Kevin Maxwell and I have dinner every once in a while to check in and kind of make sure we're on the same
Superintendent.
Page.
He went from D.C. to Prince George's County by way of Massachusetts. How'd you do that? How'd you manage to do that?
My wife, you know my wife very well. She spent 30 days in Massachusetts. She said, I need to get back to D.C. I miss Kojo.
Kaya Henderson is the Chancellor for the District of Columbia Public Schools. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have comments or questions for Rashern Baker, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. There are a few other issues I'd like to discuss with you, Tom Sherwood, before we get to the focus on Rashern Baker. This week, Marion Christopher Barry Jr. was released on his own recognizance after an arraignment in D.C. Superior Court, stemming from the incident that occurred recently at the PNC Bank in Chinatown. He pled not guilty to all three charges he's facing, making an attempted threat, destruction of property, and assault. The Washington Post has opined that he should not consider running for the Ward 8 council seat that was held by his father until these challenges are over, that he shouldn't be running, certainly in this upcoming special election, but it is clear that he intends to continue to run. He has pled not guilty to the charges.
Well, let's go to the videotape. This was a sports event, and if the PNC or the police would release the videotape, we wouldn't have to worry about what he did. But, you know, it doesn't help really in the decision-making in Ward 8, which desperately needs a new council member to have, you know, people gang up right now on Christopher Marion Barry. Marion Christopher Barry is his full name. Right now, but the people of Ward 8 really do have to decide on this. He's running. He's legally running. He has a right to run. These are, I think, misdemeanors, so there's no issue there of him being charged. And the judge, he's on probation for some driving issue, and it's up to the judge to decide whether he likes or she likes is to send him to jail for violation of probation for, you know, violating laws. But all of this is that Christopher Barry is surely and sorely untested as a person to be a community leader. He doesn't have a strong background that his father had in civil rights or community work. I think the only times I ever saw him was when he was helping to give out turkeys that his father was giving out at various holidays. So Christopher, nice young man, he has a small painting company, but he does not have the gravitas that anywhere near what his father had. And so I'm not sure that he can depend on the people of Ward 8 saying, well, he's Marion Barry's son, we've got to elect him, or the people around the city or the white people are going to be coming down on us for not supporting Barry. So I just hope that the people in Ward 8 are paying attention to Christopher. He's now apologized on the tweet, but it's what I've heard about this incident is not good for him, the city, or Ward 8.
And I know a number of the longtime activists at Ward 8 who are running for this seat resent the fact that he seems to be getting so much more attention than they are getting.
They don't want this kind of attention, but they ought to consider in a race where there's 18 or 19 people on the ballot, Christopher Barry, Marion Christopher Barry, he wants us to call him Marion C. Barry now. I'd like to see Barry do something different other than get in trouble. But, you know, with that many people on the ballot, it won't take many to get one person elected. So maybe there'll be some dropping out before we get to the vote.
Let's talk about the new Maryland governor, Larry Hogan. He's proposing cutting Medicaid reimbursements. He's proposing cutting salaries for state employees and cutting extra funding for the state's most expensive school systems. He's withdrawn regulations about the curbing the Eastern Shore farmers' use of poultry manure on their fields, according to the Washington Post. He's withdrawing regulations that would have clamped down on smog farming, air pollution. But he won an election based on the fact that people thought that it would appear they were being taxed too heavily.
Well, that's true. But he also said a lot of these things when he was running. He's doing what he said, which is kind of nice, whether you like it or not. It's for someone who gets elected and says he's going to do what he said. Now, he put off the decision on the purple line, which we'll get into in a moment, and the red line in Baltimore, and the rollback of taxes. He presented a $16.4 billion balance budget with $16.4 billion in revenues. There's no wiggle room there. And, you know, one of the county leaders from Prince George's County was there in the snow talking to people. It's very wintry-like scene, but I thought he must be getting cold shivers based on what the governor was saying, not just what the weather was like.
Sending shivers down the county executive's spine.
So maybe that'd be a nice transition.
Our guest is Rashern Baker, county executive of Prince George's County. He's a Democrat. You can call us at 800-433-8850. You can follow the conversation on our live video stream at kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Mr. County Executive, how do you expect that the plans you have for the county on all fronts, but particularly on education, are going to be affected by the budget that Larry Hogan is rolling out this week? Apparently, you'll be losing millions of dollars in education funds, according to the Washington Post.
Well, Kojo, first of all, it's just always nice being on your show, and I did not know Tom was such a poet.
He's the poet who doesn't know it.
He is very good. But you're absolutely right. We anticipated that there were going to be some issues with the budget. I should say that we're gracious and thankful that the hospital money was kept into the budget. That's a very important issue for us in Prince George's County. But the second most important issue for us is our education system. Given the budget so far that we've seen, we could lose somewhere between $19 to $20 million with the geographic index cost of doing education in the Washington region.
A similar amount for Montgomery County.
And as you know, you both know, we're under very tight restrictions in the county in terms of raising revenues. We've already committed to Dr. Maxwell. We're going to fund his budget as much as possible. Certainly, we'd like to put more in there. But I've got a $40 million deficit for fiscal year 15 and $114 million estimated deficit for fiscal year 16.
And so, when do you have to have your 16 budget before the county?
On March 15th.
Ooh.
Yes. So, you know, any cut in the state, and we said this to the governor's folks, would, you know, cutting and then rolling it back on the counties doesn't do us any good. And in terms of the progress we're making in education, this could mean teachers in the classroom. It could be a lot of the initiatives that Dr. Maxwell has proposed will be on the chopping block.
People are still waiting to see where Governor Hogan is going on the purple line. It's been reported this week that his budget will maintain funding for the project and Baltimore's red line, but he also says he's reviewing whether or not to move forward with these two projects. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm glad that at least he put a pause there. And what we've said to the governor, and he said he would listen, is that, you know, think of the purple line in a different way and think of the red line in a different way. Don't just think about it as getting people from one point A to point B, but think about it in terms of jobs and creating and expanding the commercial tax base of Prince George's County, Montgomery County, and the state of Maryland in Baltimore City. If you think about it in that terms of actually growing the business here, it's a job, you know, developer. I mean, so if, you know, what I've said to the folks up there is that the governor is committed to creating jobs. This will create, you know, thousands of jobs, not just in the building of it, but also in that will spring up around that those areas.
What I don't understand is I was looking at Bethesda Now, which is a blog, and somebody responded to the governor's budget and the lack of the purple line decision by saying, make a damn decision. I mean, we have known this this uncertainty about the purple line from Governor Hogan, candidate Hogan, a year ago when no one thought he would win and before Anthony Brown's campaign vanished into thin air. But he won. It's been months since the November 4th election. He's had the time to do what is it that he doesn't like? I know he likes roadways in rural areas of the state too, but why can't he make a decision about the purple line?
You know, well, I think to be fair to the governor, I mean, he is just now taking over as somebody.
You don't have to schmooze the governor here.
No, you know, any
executive. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Any executive that's coming in is going to want to look at everything. What we've said to him is exactly what you have just said, Tom, and that is this has been around for a long time. It's a public-private partnership. So that's something that most Republicans like. And the business community loves you know, building the Purple Line because they see that it's going to create jobs.
And it's just one third of its state money.
Right.
It's $750 million.
$1.2 billion
with private and other monies.
And no, it's a great project. And I think once the governor, and we've said to our business community, you know, this is your time to weigh in to the governor. Once you look at it and you think about how are you going to create jobs in the state of Maryland, this is a job creator.
How about a larger picture on transportation, the number one issue in this region, right? Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. Arlington has killed the streetcar project. Mayor Bowser is on the verge of killing the streetcar project in the city. This 37-mile system may never see the light of day. It may never get started on 8th Street, much less get. Now, that's a lot of money. You've got the Purple Line hanging in the balance. Apart from Baltimore, it seems to me there's no new American Legion Bridge. It's been talked about, not discussed. You've got roadway issues all right. over Prince George's County. It seems the metropolitan region has come to a stop on trying to build for the very – we're going to grow by millions of people between 2040, and you have to build the roads in the system now. No one seems to be doing it.
Well, that's just it. That's the point we're making in Annapolis is you've got to plan for the future. It's both County Executive Leggett and myself, Mayor Rawlings Blake in Baltimore, we're making that pitch to Annapolis and to the governor that, you know, you've got to plan for the future. We're expecting Prince George's County to grow by 2020 to over 1 million people. Montgomery County is already at 1 million people.
And the city of Washington is going to be at 800.
Right. So you've got all these folks that are coming here, and we've got to think of a way now and start preparing for how do we move these folks back and forth. And then how do we take advantage of it to actually increase job opportunities and increase business opportunities? So stopping the Purple Line after we've already invested in it, it's a bad idea.
I'm glad you said you talked to your delegation because you spent some 9 years in the House. You were the head of the Prince George's County delegation.
Right.
What kind of pushback do you see coming from the General Assembly to the governor's plans?
Well, I think you'll see a lot, especially you get the two largest delegations, Prince George's County and Montgomery County, that are saying we need this. You've got Baltimore City, which is a significant delegation. It's the fourth largest, I believe. So we've talked to the leadership, both Speaker Bush and President Miller. We certainly are talking to the Transportation Committee chairs, and they get it, and we're asking them to push the governor on this. This is very important. This is not a minor issue. This is a very important economic issue.
We're talking with Rashawn Baker, a county executive of Prince George's County, Maryland. He is a Democrat. Inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or follow the live video stream at our website, kojoshow.org.
I want to mention Peter Franchro. He's going to be sworn in on Monday.
The comptroller.
Comptroller, yes. Comptroller or controller?
Comptroller.
You know,
pronunciations of English, it is called control.
Let's get Kaya Henderson back in here. Third, only the fourth, he put out a press release, only the fourth controller to be serving a third term. His inauguration is on Monday. Are you going to go? Is he an ally for what the county needs?
I think yes. I think coming from Montgomery County, he understands, especially on the transit issues.
He might be one of your opponents for governor in 4 years.
We actually got a tweet from Joshua who said, will Mr. Baker run for governor? Do you care to answer that question now?
Mr. Baker will be down there fighting for funding for Prince George's County in Annapolis. But, you know, certainly, you know, the Board of Public Works is very important. Both Comptroller Franchro and Nancy Kopp are friends of ours. I serve with them both on appropriations.
Who is she? So people will know who she is.
She's the treasurer of the state of Maryland, and she sits on the Board of Public Works, which oversees, you know, a lot of our contracts and building. So certainly we're forging a relationship with both to very important. We've differed on some issues with the comptroller, one being a destination resort casino, which will be a $1 billion project and bring in millions of dollars to the state and to the county. But certainly I think he understands the transit and I look for it. And he understands the need for expanding opportunities for minority and local businesses.
He likes the earlier start time for schools too, for that.
Yeah. He wants to start schools after Labor Day again, the way they used to do it in the old days.
Yeah. You know, I understand the business decision. I mean, one of the reasons we actually began before Labor Day was that we wanted more time for our kids in the classroom, more chances for our opportunity. And as a county that we're trying to make improvements in our education system, and we're starting to see it, you know, I'm always in favor of having our children in school more.
Why not year-round schooling? We're a modern society. Why don't we have year-round schooling, summer school just for people who are not
I wish you'd asked me that when I was in school. I would have known what to tell you.
You know what, Tom? I mean, I know you don't say that in jest, but that that is a very legitimate question.
We should be thinking about the business of education is a year-round project.
I think one of the things, and this is what I like about having Dr. Maxwell as our superintendent, is we've got to think of, you know, differently about education. Not maybe for every school, but maybe like Virginia did, where you kind of do a test model on year-round schooling and see where, you know.
And you have a summer jobs program too, don't you? Why don't we have summer jobs year round? Particularly high school students in the 10th grade or so can work a couple of hours after school, fill in some of that time when they're not involved in sports or other school activities, actually have jobs as a transition issue.
You know, we're actually looking at that as we expand our summer job opportunities, and the state's attorney, Angela Alsobrook, has been a big proponent of this. But we're also taking that to the next level, which is how do we keep them working during the school year with mentorship? Because the idea is to not just have a summer job, but actually start directing folks to careers so they could be, you know, the next coach.
Maybe something early in the morning.
If you live in Prince George's County, give us a call. Tell us what you want to see in the future for your county. 800-433-8850 in the area of education. Here is Scott in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Scott, you are now on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. Good morning, Mr. Baker.
Good morning.
I was wondering if you've put any thought into reducing the emphasis on standardized tests, particularly high-stakes tests. I had my children, I'm in Upper Marlboro, down at Baden Elementary. It was a lovely school for my son's kindergarten, first grade. New principal came in. It was all about the test. Teacher morale went down. Kids were miserable. I'm sorry to say I pulled my son out, and now we go to private Montessori. It broke my heart because Baden was a beautiful school. It was an integrated school, real nice mix, and great community support. And now I've talked to other people, and next year a lot of people are pulling their kids out too.
Yeah, it's you know, and I know Baden, and you're right. It was a great integrated school in the county, and really active parents who have been involved. You know, the big thing that we've said all along is, you know, teaching to the test does not create lifelong learners, and that's what we want in our school system. And so that's going to be part of the conversation that's going to happen at the state level. Unfortunately, a lot of these decisions are made at the state level and they filter down to the county level. One of the things I can say is Dr. Maxwell and his team are looking at how we make sure that we make, you know, education interesting for kids. We make them want to learn, and we let teachers be teachers. A lot of times when you're teaching to the test, it doesn't allow those innovative, great teachers who have experience just teach and know how to teach individual kids coming in. So I'm hopeful, you know, in the county, we're blessed that, you know, the new vice chair of the Education and Environment Committee on the Senate side is Senator Pinsky, who knows a lot about education, and we're hoping that working with him and others that we can look at some of these things.
It seems like the schools are constantly reinventing themselves, whether it's back to basics or whether it's No Child Left Behind, whether it's core curriculum. It seems to be a kind of bureaucratic ginning of resetting the deck chairs.
But there seems to be increasing agreement that there are too many standardized
tests. A few years ago, we had to have standardized tests, impact this and impact that. And the president, I think Bush, about let's measure these teachers. And why don't we have a standard that every school should teach a kid to read by the third grade unless he or she has some developmental disability who can't? And just have some.
You think Tom has a future in politics?
He has a lot of great ideas.
I mean, it's just astonishing to me that we don't have a system where we just say, okay, you'll learn, and we're just now in the city starting bilingual education. And just make that a requirement in the third grade. And maybe if the parents can't read, help teach them to read.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we've seen and what Dr.
I'm a little grumpy today. I apologize.
I think he's trying to get a job in Prince George's
County. We're about to hire him.
I hadn't even started about the MGM casino yet.
Yeah. Oh, we're
it's
going to
be fabulous. We can't wait to have you over there.
I have a downside to it coming
I'm
out.
Glad we're going there because Nikki is in Oxon Hill, Maryland, and wants to talk about an issue that I suspect is related to that. Nikki, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
You are so right, Kojo. I really, good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
everyone.
This is the nicest voice we've had in a long time on the show. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really would love to hear what the Mr. Baker has to say about the traffic on Indian Head Highway 210, which I want specifics. And please let me know when the next meeting is. Do you have a casino that's going to just make things worse? I can already tell you the uptick in traffic with the outlet that has just opened up, not to mention the continuing increase in traffic from Waldorf and the Accokeek area. Thank you.
And that's not what you expected when you moved there, was it?
I've lived there for 20-plus years, and this is an abomination. It is now taking me an hour and a half to get to work sometimes in the district.
Ooh, look at the
executive
voice there.
The county executive.
You know, Coach, it'll be...
encouraging this.
No,
stoking the fire.
You know, here's the... And when we talk about, funding from the state, 210 is a state highway. And getting the revenues to come into 210 is our fight down in Annapolis to make sure we get the funding for it. When we got the casino bill passed, we made sure that we targeted dollars for 210 to be revived, to be expanded and looked at. But the problem is, quite honestly, is making sure at the state level that we get the funding in there. We've committed at the county level that 210 is the number one priority for us. So when we submit our priorities each year to the state, we have made it for the last 2 years 210. And the commitment from the state, at least in the past administration, is that they will provide that funding.
And would the construction start if that were to if in the best of worlds, wouldn't you want the construction now to be in place before it opens?
Certainly.
But
certainly.
Where is it? Where is it?
Well, it's a matter of getting the resources from the state to start it. When you start any of these, the first part of it is actually doing the during the build and design stage, is looking at it and doing the design. So that is the first leg of the money, which is committed from the state to do that.
Is that underway?
That is underway. That's been a commitment under the state. And then the access roads for the county we're working on. But here's the issue. 210 has been a major problem for years. The reason we're able to now to direct money from it from the state is that we're actually bringing in projects that will bring in revenues. So Tanger Outlet is great for us because it captures some of that traffic in Prince George's County where they spend the money. And they also bring revenues into the state. So what we have to now do is make sure at the state level, the commitment is already there at the county level. The funds that we have will be targeted toward those areas to make sure we do, both in terms of roads and in terms of public safety. But we also have to convince our friends, because this is a state highway in Charles County, in St. Mary's County, that are coming through there, that is not just a Prince George's County issue. That the traffic that's flowing through there is flowing from the southern part of the state through Prince
George's
County.
Is that something you also have to convince Governor Hogan of?
Yes.
Yeah, but Charles County has to be on board, right?
That's right. Charles County has to be on board. St. Mary's County has to be on board. The governor has to be on board because this is impacting traffic that's coming through. If we did not have Tanger and we did not have the casino, we would still have traffic issues there.
Washingtonian Magazine recently made you one of its Washingtonians of the Year.
I was there when I saw him all smiling. I left before his long speech.
Tom, you should know, was way ahead of you as a Washingtonian of the Year.
And so were you.
In their piece about you, you said that you want people to bring back what the county felt like when you moved there in the 80s, that this was a place on the rise. To the degree that it hasn't been, in your view, on the rise, how would you explain that?
Well, I think, there was a period of time, especially after, the hoopla over the Curry administration, where we really thought that, this is it. This is, the promised land. And there was a lull. And I think when I came in, certainly people didn't feel like, it was a great place to invest in if you were a business. People had real concerns about education. We didn't have issues like traffic stopping in Prince George's County because it was all passing through. I think what you've seen over the last 4 years, and it's because we've had some terrific workers, that, you know, we've got three cranes up at the southern end for the casino. We've got the hospital money that we're going to build at Largo Metro Station. We've got cranes going up that are building at New Carrollton, where the new building is going to be. We have a Wegmans and a Harris Teeter in the northern end, and things are happening. Our school system's improving, crime's down to record lows, and I think people are starting to feel like, you know what, this is a great place to live, work, and invest in.
Can I ask quickly about that? When do you anticipate there will be an FBI headquarters decision, 11,000 jobs? Is it a year or two away?
It's my understanding it's 18 months away, but we feel really good about where we are. And it probably gets to one of your questions, one of the questions that came up earlier about traffic. What we're starting to do and learn from what happened in 210 is investing resources and dollars around both Greenbelt and Landover, so that the anticipation of the FBI coming in and the traffic issues, and we'll be, you know, lobbying the state for more dollars around that.
Since you were last here, the Children's Museum, which had moved from the district to National Harbor, never quite found a place there in terms of audience, and now is out of National Harbor and is looking back in the district again. With the MGM Casino and how those are self-contained places where you can stay, eat, drink, gamble, do everything without leaving. Is there any concern at all that the casino will swoop up all these folks who will not have time or the resources to go to National Harbor? Why will they have to go down the road?
Only have about a minute left.
I would say real quickly that's why we limited the number of rooms, hotel rooms, at the casino. It is also why we limited the number of clothing outlets at the casino, so that people would be able to take advantage of National Harbor and Tanger.
We're out of time, so you're going to ask me about the April 20th thing?
Exactly right. A lot of people begin the year with New Year's resolutions, big intentions that this will be the year they hit the gym, change their diet. I've heard that you're gearing up for an awfully big personal challenge, as Tom mentioned, on April 20th.
I am. I'm going to run the Boston Marathon, or at least I'm training to run the Boston Marathon. It's more like probably walking the Boston Marathon, but I'm excited.
Have you run a marathon? I mean, have you run 26.3?
You've done the Army 10 mile, right?
Army 10 mile. 10 miles is the furthest I've ever run, so I am training right now.
We've got to make sure we have a Channel 4 camera for that.
Given the pace that he's running at, he might be able to run for governor in Massachusetts.
Water, I need water, help. But it's a good thing, because health and fitness is a big deal for everybody.
Rashawn Baker is the executive of Prince George's County, Maryland. He's a Democrat. Good luck to you. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Back to work.
I am not running any marathon.
He's going back to work next week. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi Show, what test scores miss. Research shows students with qualities like grit and self-control are more likely to succeed in college, but these traits are often overlooked in admissions. Then at 1, the battle over bigger houses. Neighborhoods debate so-called pop-ups and the rule around adding to existing structures. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
And coming up next, it's
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nandi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.